That is awesome. Hello and welcome to the Crate and Crowbar. This is episode 163, recorded on the 25th of October. I'm Tom Francis, and with me here today are...
Tom Zinia.
And...
John Roberts.
What is the news, which we didn't think to discuss before recording
this? We talked about Red Dead last week, so that's not news anymore.
Mm-hmm.
There's rumours that GTA 5 Online is going to be expanded dramatically in the coming years, with the addition of new cities and zones. As well as activities and things.
Battlefield 1 came out, right?
Battlefield 1 came out. And also Civilization 6. There's loads of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Everything's coming out now because it's the release season.
I somehow missed that Battlefield 1 came out. Like, I heard Chris talk about it on the last podcast. He was playing like an early version at that point. And so then all future discussion of it, I just attributed to this early version everyone else had that I didn't. But I was actually looking forward to that, and I haven't discovered that it came out because... Presumably, it's only on Origin, is it?
It is, yeah.
It's in the deep, dark pit that I never look in.
Yep. It's cursed. So it is. Like, I assume Titanfall 2 will be cursed.
Oh, God,
well.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's this Friday, I believe.
Man. Given that they're both published by the same company, does it seem like a bit of a strategic error to release those two things right after each other?
That's a good point, but my theory is that Battlefield is the kind of shooter-fan-shooter where they have, like, full lobbies and ways of kind of, you know, creating games, and it's a familiar kind of more hardcore experience, and Titanfall is there this year's Star Wars Battlefront, where it's just a drop in and shoot a robot and then just a completely casual, almost like Call of Duty level experience. But it does seem somewhat mad to release them within a week of each other.
When is the new Call of Duty?
Like next week.
Okay, that makes more sense. Like, right, if you're gonna swamp people with shooters, do it right before your rival releases their shooter.
That's a good point. I'm excited to play all three of the shooters this year, which is unusual.
That's unusual for me too, and also true in my case. Like, they're all... I wasn't interested in Battlefield 1s until Chris started talking about it, and that actually sounds quite unusual. And the other two are sci-fi, so easy to sell.
I'm quite excited to have an emotional story with a big robot.
Yeah. I saw a review on a site, I now can't remember which one it was, the headline was that Titanfall is more like Half-Life than Call of Duty.
Whoa. Quite a claim.
Hmm.
I have to wait and see if that one. That wasn't my site. That's how I think about it.
No, it wasn't. I don't remember that one.
Yeah, all I want is a brotherhood with a robot. That's a brilliant angle for a Titanfall single player, isn't it? And some of the kind of... they've only shown glimpses of it, but it looks amazing. There's a sequence where you're in a ship and you board another ship by jumping out of your ship, free-running on a third ship, and then jumping onto the enemy ship, and then you get into a firefight that way.
Is this Titanfall?
This is Titanfall 2, yeah. So it involves loads of stuff like that, just loads of stunts and crazy wall running and also occasional robot bits for pace. It could be a really, really good single player.
Seems like a good season for getting in and out of ships. Yes, thing that I like to do.
Only today I played the Battlefield 1 single player mission where you shoot up a Zeppelin, then while it's on fire you crash land on top of it, then go inside the Zeppelin and kill a load of Germans. And it was really fun. Really, really silly.
I think I've done that before in a game. Maybe... Do you do it in Bioshock Infinite?
It's definitely... You definitely board ships and blow
them up. Yeah, you board airships in Bioshock Infinite. Yeah, I feel like there's another one where there's like a really big ship and you go inside it and there's a whole level inside and it's already on fire. May still be Bioshock Infinite.
It happened a few times in Bioshock Infinite. It was always great as well. Like, more games should do that. It's really, really good.
Yeah. Being inside a thing that's moving, it's pretty cool. What have you guys been playing?
I have been playing The Witcher 3. Mm-hmm. Like, massively late, but nobody wants to hear about that. I also played The Final Station, which is a indie game, side-on pixel art, as is required, about driving a train across the country as society collapses around you in some kind of apocalypse.
Is this published by Tiny Build?
Yes.
Yeah, this looks great. The art does, anyway.
Yeah. I think you showed me it a while ago, and I thought, ooh, that's very nice. I really like the design of this this cool industrial brutalist train, and just the fiction of driving this train across the landscape, trying to survive and stuff like that was really cool. But it's kind of a side-on shooter where you travel from station to station and your little train driver jumps out and goes scavenging for resources and ammo and stuff like that. The main point is he has to jump off every time because the very sort of mildly dystopian government that this civilization has produced has put blockers on every single station, which you need to get a four-digit code for. So every new station you go for, you have to get out of the train.
Ah, okay.
And they're supposed to be in the control building right next to the station. And so far, they've come up with at least 10 conceited reasons for the code not to be there. Like, the manager has gone to lunch. Can't find the manager.
I love the idea of this really mild dystopia. We're just going to slightly inconvenience you. We're not going to stop you from travel. You can still go anywhere you like, but you just have to punch in this four-digit code.
It's quite an interesting setting. It's very subtle with its storytelling. It's like a year on since some kind of weird event happened. They call it either First Contact or the Visitation or something like that. Some thing happened, and then the story begins a year later. And I don't know if you've ever seen a film called Monsters.
No.
Which is really great. It's weird alien things appear in Central America, and humanity just kind of deals with it. They just put up big walls and just leave them to it. And so everyone's kind of aware that there's these weird monsters, but it doesn't really affect their daily lives and stuff like that. And it's kind of a similar feeling of this game. But it's a year on since that weird thing happened, and something is happening. People are starting to ooze black gunk from their eyes and that sort of thing. And you are dispatched across the country as a train driver to take various important people from station to station and carry goods and stuff. And as you travel around, things happen in the background. It's got quite a nice way of storytelling in that as you travel, you just see backgrounds flashing past behind the train. And they're just nice, subtle things like you can see the shape of the cities and see that they're quite futuristic. And then you'll go through a bridge and then you'll come across like an old battlefield where like war machines have been bombed out. And cool, just little subtle visuals like that. And then you have passengers on your train talking about what really happened a year ago. Some people believe it, some people don't.
So you're like the driver of a passenger train?
Yeah. You're kind of like a weird... It's like an industrial government train. And the point is, it's not the best one on the line. It's really shonky. So you have to go... As you're driving along, you have to go and fiddle with dials and push buttons and stuff like that in case the power overloads and you stop generating oxygen in the train and strange stuff like that, which gives you something to do along the way. But yeah, slowly some terrible event, this black goop starts overtaking the populace and everyone basically turns into zombies. So you have to get your pistol out and go and shoot a bunch of people. What's the game you played where you're like death and you can go into toilets up through vents and stuff?
Lock something. Lockdown. Deadlock. Deadbolt. Deadbolt.
Deadbolt. It's quite similar to that. It's quite a hard or punishing combat system, at least. You're always very low on ammo. Once the weird black goo zombies catch up with you, you'll go down in a few hits and stuff like that. So it's got kind of survival elements, and you're kind of hoarding med packs and collecting food and stuff because you get passengers on your train, and they're like any good survival game, their bars for food and health are constantly rocketing down incredibly quickly, so you have to top them up if you want to get them to their destination and get some sort of reward, be it cash or medicine or bullets or anything like that. I've only played a couple of hours and quite excited to go back to it.
Hmm. Deadbolt is very satisfying as a shooter. Is this?
It's not as good as that. It's you've got WASD movement and kind of analog mouse aiming. And you can get headshots on zombies and stuff like that, so it's quite fun. But the range of stuff you can do in combat, at least at the beginning or a couple of hours in, like I am, it's kind of limited. You can shoot, you can punch if you're desperate, and you can pick up stuff in the environment like chairs and toilets and stuff and throw them at zombies, which is quite fun. But that's basically the end of it.
Hmm.
And often you'll open a door and there'll be five zombies in your face and they'll claw you immediately and you'll die, which is a little bit annoying. But it's fairly frequent checkpoints, so you don't lose a lot of time.
Hmm. Is it out?
Yes.
Just fully, completely out?
Yeah, not fully out on Steam.
Man, I was looking forward to that game, and last I heard of it, it was just like, I think they announced like three games at once, they had all these different prototypes, and it was, the message I got was that they're all super early, and that wasn't that long ago, and so I hadn't been like looking out for it.
To be fair, it does feel a little rushed.
Hmm.
I don't want to be too mean about the art, but to me at least it feels kind of unfinished. There's various nice bits, like the characters are nicely drawn and have a lot of character, and the train itself is quite nice, but the environments are often very bland. It's a little like Gunpoint in that it's slices of buildings and stuff like that. Mm. But anything that you can't see is just this bland grey kind of fog of war. It's a little bit disappointing because often like 80% of your screen will just be grey.
Particularly that's their main kind of storytelling device, is background drama and stuff.
Fog of War, man. It's just this trope that people just put in there by default.
And it was an engine limitation when it was first introduced, obviously.
It makes sense in like competitive strategy games, but I think in so many single-player games, it's way better if you can just see everything.
Mm.
it's visually prettier, it's more interesting tactically, and it doesn't have to be realistic. Like, I've never heard anyone complain that, oh, in Gunpoint, why can't I see the guy in the next room? I shouldn't be able to see him. No one's ever said that.
In comparison, the sound design is really nice.
Hmm.
It's a very, when it's scored at all, it's very nice ambient music. But they do a lot just with silence and sound effects and soundscapes and that kind of thing. Like, you pull into one station at night and it's just completely silent apart from a few very small noises and the rustle of someone's paper as he reads it. And it's like, I've been in that situation.
Yeah.
That's a very strong sense memory. And it just conjured that up straight away, so they've done quite well there.
That's Chippenham Station. Have you played, is it Duelist, the card game that
you
guys have been playing? Have you played that, John?
No.
I was asking because I heard good things about it, wanted to play it, and I did start playing it, and I was in a mood where I was just running through a whole bunch of things that were kind of overdue and was going to see which one grabbed my interest. And I started that, and everything seemed fine, except that the characters are pixel art, and everything else is a different resolution to the pixels, and it really bothered me, and I know that also bothers you in some games, so I want to know if that's just me or
I'm getting angry, you just described it.
It's line thickness in vector art and stuff when it varies. When characters could be standing next to each other, their outline thickness of the characters are different, and it's they should be different rooms and different games instead of how is this consistent? But I guess it's the only thing that sort of thing you really notice if you dealt with art. Maybe it's a generally you just don't notice it.
Yeah, I think there are loads of situations where I wouldn't notice it, if it's pixel art and the pixels are just slightly different sizes, then I probably wouldn't always, but this is really, it's intentional, it's very pointed that these are super pixelated and everything else is super not, which the fact that it's intentional should make me more easygoing about it, but it doesn't. What have you been playing, Tom?
I've been playing Civilization VI.
Ah, me too.
Yeah, it's every bit as addictive, possibly the one of the most Moorish civs ever, probably. However, I've played it a lot now, and I have quite a few problems with it, and I'm not convinced that, beyond that surface level, just one more turn pleasure, there's actually much kind of strategic meat to it, and much kind of interest in terms of defining your civilization, or kind of finding interesting ways to play it that aren't just level all the numbers up in your territory, and then win. Plus, I've had a bunch of problems with the AI just doing just batshit things to me. But maybe, I don't know, that's just been my experience with it. How about you, Tom?
I do not like it. And so I thought, I disagree with everyone because everyone's saying it's the best Civ in ages. But then when I examine my problems with it, I think I just don't like Civ. don't dislike it. But it's Civ 4, 5, and 6 all kind of feel like the same game to me. Not in a bad way. And I previously had never really played Civ. Civ 4 was the first one I really gave a lot of time to. And I liked that game enough to sort of play like 4 or 5 long games of it over those three games. I should say like 4 or 5 matches of it over those 3 installments in the series. Because the word game means a lot of different things here. And I find especially in 5 and 6, the like series of interesting decisions thing that Sid Meier says that's what games should be,
yeah,
really isn't. It's like 90% utterly uninteresting decisions. It's like constantly being saying, this unit needs orders, this unit needs orders, this unit needs orders. And it's someone who I sent to go from my city to the enemy city. It's a military unit, I need him to be at the enemy city. He's currently not. I want him to be there. I've clicked there, and then he just gets stuck, and he gets stuck, and he gets stuck, and he gets stuck. Because, like, units can move through each other, but they need enough movement points to get to the other tile, and if they don't have that, then they sort of, they don't cancel their order exactly, they just, I suppose they do, because they demand that you tell them to do something else. Like, they won't do, you can't even go to next turn until you tell them to do something.
Mm.
And you can, it's, the ability to, like, just have them skip a turn is not well broadcast. That is in there, but for a long time I thought you had to either tell them to go somewhere or tell them to sleep.
Right.
And if you tell them to sleep, it'll never tell you about them again. Unless you specifically find them and click on them and wake them up.
Mm.
Whereas what I really want them to do is just keep trying. You know where you got to go.
Mm.
And, like, just, you know, obviously from a usability perspective, it'd be good to have a solution to this problem. But also just, it's really obvious on, like, the sort of logic side of it. I've told you to go to a tile. You, when I told you to go there, you had a clear path there. You know this, because otherwise you wouldn't have accepted it as a valid order. And if your path is now blocked, the place you're trying to move to on this turn, there's someone there, you know that not only is that thing, is it possible for that thing to move, but also that thing is currently moving. It just moved there. Like, it wasn't there before, and now it is. So you know it's, like, on its way somewhere else. So just wait. Just wait, like, one turn. It'll be gone next turn. Just, like, calm down. But they're all just like, no, where do I go? Where do I go? Where do I go? And I have, like, I was playing just a very quick game on a tiny map, and that involved having about, you know, 12 military units out there. And it was just a nightmare. It was just taking me so long to get through any turn. It just, and like, one of the worst things about it is I really hate when playing a game is a matter of, like, progress bars and error messages. And the unit needs orders ends up feeling like an error message because when someone is already on their way there, like, during this turn, I've not given them any new orders. And so they don't do anything until the end of your turn. So it's when you click the next turn button, then it tries to process all the things that are kind of queued up that you haven't given any specific attention to this turn. And so it's telling you you can end your turn.
Mm-hmm.
And then it says, no, 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 actually this guy needs orders. And when it's doing that like 15 times, it's just like 15 error messages every time you want to progress through a turn.
Yeah.
It's so irritating.
Is that the kind of problem where using a kind of basic enough AI to give them, make them react intelligently in that kind of situation would mean that everything in your civilization just runs itself?
Well, I feel like I still want to, once they get there, I still want to micromanage, like, who should be at the very front of the battle and keep my catapults 2 spaces back and, like, okay, you're adjacent to the city, but there's also an enemy adjacent to you. Should you attack the enemy or the city? That's an interesting decision. I want to make all those decisions, but just to, until you're there, just shut the fuck up and just get on with it. Just keep trying to get there. You don't need any further orders from me. I've told you where I want you. Keep trying to get to that space until I tell you to do something else. And yeah, so I don't think it would make it too easy or anything. But yeah, what I can't remember is whether I had this problem in Civ 4, because in Civ 4 units could have occupied the same space,
yeah,
right? But was that some kind of special system where they had to have enough, like, you know, only certain types of units could do that? Or
don't think so. I think they just stacked.
So that must have been much less of a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
I don't remember it, because at that time I'd never experienced the alternative.
Civ 6 has the thing where you can unlock a technology that lets you stack units, if they're the same, and up to, I think, 3 of them if you've got the right tech, which is useful, and that kind of ameliorates the problem a little bit. But I think the bigger problem for me is that you're right, I had the same irritation about just moving things around hexes forever. But to me, the military game was the most interesting of the kind of 4 games that are contained within Civ 6. And the other games are about passively making resources grow from these tiles without any sense that you're actually crafting a civilization at all. It's almost like, I've talked to other people about it, saying it's like planting a garden. And you might as well just be planting, you know, roses and then watering them every now and then. There's no sense you're actually crafting civilization. You choose your government, and they've got quite a cool new system for setting your government, and it gives you kind of a series of card slots in like military or economic spheres, and you can drag and drop the civics you've researched into these, and that theoretically lets you kind of define the policy for your empire. But all of them are just like plus one gold from each trade route, or plus 5% experience for certain types of combat unit. And okay, I've defined my policy, and it's all just tiny, irrelevant kind of stat bonuses. How is that? That's not a government. That's just the whole game is about resource gathering efficiency, not about building a civilization anymore.
I can see that there probably are combinations of those things that end up being really effective. I had like one instance where, because I've built up such a big military, I unlocked a civic, that reduced the upkeep cost of everything by a little bit. And because I had so much stuff, slotting that in gave me a lot more money, so that was kind of nice.
Mm.
But yeah, I've written a bit of an interview with Sid Meier by Chris Pratt and Eurogamer, in which he said that he's explaining what they're trying to do with Civilization, which is like they don't, anytime they add something, they've got to scale back on something else. It does not feel like they did that at all here. Mm. But he spoke very eloquently about how the player needs to totally understand that they can't be confused about what is currently going on, because they need to understand that so well they are thinking about what's going to go on next, and that's when they can have interesting decisions, is planning out those things.
That has not happened.
And because of that thing you mentioned where like all those civics, they're like little cards that you can slot into different slots, and you have like up to, as far as I played, like 4 different slots, and I've already got like about 12 different civics, and all of those have these little bonuses to little things in little circumstances, and I can't put all of that in my head, I can't visualise what that looks like, so I can't make smart decisions about what to slot in where. I just sort of read them, and if one of them sounds like, oh, that could be useful, I put that in there. And the same with like the tech tree. In theory, I really like tech trees, and I like sort of picking what I'm going to specialise in and going down that route. But again, they're just like, every building is just plus one to this and minus one to that, and in this circumstance you get plus one to everything that has this kind of resource and that kind of stuff. And I can't keep all that information in my head, I have to read every single one of them. And then even once you read the text, sometimes you need to search Civilopedia to find out, okay, that building that you're telling me I can unlock, where can I place it? Can I place it here? No, I'm not going to place it in any of my cities, there's no point in going for that. And it's all so complex, there's all so many little rules and exceptions, like I don't know them all. So I can't make smart decisions. I look at the tech tree and I just think, I don't know, just whatever.
I just
look at like one unit. I guess I want that unit. So whatever I have to do to get that unit, just work towards that.
I always felt like the decisions, like I can't think of a single genuinely useful decision I made in any of my campaigns. Everything is so micro, and it's so just kind of tweaking here and tweaking there. I've never made like a big, I'm going to be a theocracy, and I'm doing that because I want to go for this victory, and actually I'm going to tackle my neighbours in this way, because it's not a game about that anymore at all, I don't think. Plus, partly because the AI is in the games I've played, it's been nuts. I've had people coming up to me and making like really lucrative trade deals where I've been trading kind of silk and marble with them for huge amounts of money. I set up traders with them, and I've been trading them for decades. And then, like 5 turns later, after they came to me with a trade deal, they'll declare a surprise war on me, even though I have a military that is twice the size of theirs and like several eras of advancements beyond them. So then I'll counterattack, and I'll take 2 or 3 of their cities, and I'll come back with a peace deal, and I'll let them have it. And then, like 10 turns later, they'll wage a war on me for having occupied those cities in that war that they stupidly started with me. And this happens constantly, and irrespective of who I'm dealing with, which leader, like the Civ leaders are supposed to have personalities and agendas and things, but they all behave in the same erratic, just irrational way, to the extent that it's kind of, when you put it up against Galciv or you put it up against Ender's Legend, it's so bad in comparison to those games now. I think the Civilization series has kind of drifted and kind of coached on its own reputation for so long now, and it's being surpassed by other games these days.
It definitely made me realise that the game I want is just not a civilization game. If I joined Firaxis and became like, I replaced Sid Meier, and I just got to tell everyone exactly what to do and made the game I wanted to make, the end of it, any sane publisher would say, well, we can't release this under the civilization name.
Right.
I would want to scrap so much of it and simplify it so much. And I've been waiting for them to do that, and now I realize that, oh, they're never going to do that, because I don't know whether it's their own attachment to the mechanics or whether it's their the fan's attachment to the mechanics, but like nothing is going to be taken out. It's all just going to be piled on and on. This is like, this has, as far as I know, every single feature of Civ 5 with all of its expansions. Like, it's got religion, it's got tourism, it's got all the enhancements that made, and it just starts with that, and I don't know what they're going to imply. Actually, one thing that did sound exciting, I hadn't done it, but I was reading up on like how to go for a culture victory, and apparently that, this does not sound exciting now that I say it, but apparently that involves having a higher tourism score than all the other civilizations at the end of a certain period of time, which is, I don't know, is that culture? I suppose it is.
But, I thought that was a deeply cynical interpretation of culture.
Yeah. I mean, it used to be. The thing I love about culture in the 4X games that I originally got into was that you use it to steal cities from people. You culture flip, right? You put so much culture in their face that all their people just join your civilization instead of theirs, and then you like own them, and it's awesome. Which maybe is also not really a very charitable interpretation of culture. Mm. But the guide I read said that you should get seaside resorts, have like a double, they get double tourism points for everything. And then if you build the Eiffel Tower, that doubles the tourism score of everything you have. Mm. And so you can quadruple the score of those things. And then if you place them on some certain kind of tile, you also get a culture bonus to that. And so it's like a way of stacking all these like modifiers. And I like stacking modifiers. So in theory, I'd be up for that. But again, I would never have known to do that because I would have to read every fucking tooltip on every one of the 300 texts I had access to.
Yeah.
Or could potentially work towards.
I found the culture stuff like completely absurd because all the civilizations in a game are in a race to impress, it seems, great leaders, like great generals, great artists. And if you achieve a certain score ahead of other people, you get to recruit them, basically. As though they're waiting in the wings. And oh, Rome, you're pretty good. I'll go with you if you want to. So
they're just standing in like the wilderness. They're barbarians. None of the civilizations are civilized enough for me. I'm just going to stand here in a tree.
So I was Rome, and I reached the point where I was impressive enough to Jane Austen that she that she would join my civilization. So she came along. She was just standing there in Rome. And she's ready. She's just primed to produce like Sense and Sensibility and Pride and Prejudice. She's just so ready. But the trouble is, you need cultural slots to hold the great works that artists produce. And I didn't have any slots for Pride and Prejudice or Sense and Sensibility. So I was like, okay. I put Jane Austen to sleep in Rome, and then I went off and I built an amphitheatre. And then I sent her to the amphitheatre, woke her up and sent her to the amphitheatre, and then she wrote Pride and Prejudice and installed it in the amphitheatre, and that gave me 4 culture points and 8 tourism points. And I thought, this game is fucking stupid.
I thought with the stretches of time that civilization encompasses, you've like cryogenically froze Jane Austen in the Rome period and thaw her out when the technology is available to deliver the proper vision.
Just imprisoned her, and then I don't know what she did in the amphitheatre or how, like just a quite mild-mannered book about social affairs.
Surrounding the whole crowd like cheering on every time she writes a sentence.
In that same Eurogamer interview, Sid talks about the very broad idea of civilization sequels. It should be something like a third of core civilization, a third is improvements on the previous version, and a third is brand new stuff. Does it feel like there's newness in this one?
No, not
to me. Not to me, anyway.
But the policy stuff, the government design stuff is technically new, but...
Yeah, so I remember having civics in the previous game, but I can't remember... Now
yeah,
they're a whole
track is new, yeah.
Now they're a tech tree, like just like the real tech tree.
Yeah.
And I think that sort of exposes how similar they are to things you already have in the tech tree. Like, I don't really see why it can't just be a branch of the tech tree.
Yeah, for sure.
The other thing that sounded exciting that I also haven't done is apparently it's possible to steal great works from other civs.
Yeah.
If you have espionage. That sounds awesome. If I can steal a painting from another civilization.
I've bullied the Empire of Congo to the extent they just gave me most of their great works of art.
Wow.
Just so that they could have peace, and then I destroyed them. But I stress I never declared war on anyone in that playthrough, and it was a military conquest playthrough, and I didn't declare war on anyone actively. I just waited for them to come and just stupidly declare war on me, even though I was just fast, really had a really powerful military.
In my game, my first war was because I was trying to move a unit somewhere and someone was in my way, and there was no way, like, I just couldn't get there unless this person moved, so I just had to kill them. Just in order to do that, I had to declare war on their whole civilization. And then, like a few turns later, they begged for peace because they had way more military units, and then I took their peace deal at enormous expense to them. And it's not just expense, but like they pay an ongoing amount of money. And then they denounced me, which is the thing you do to prepare for war, because the only effect of denouncing someone is that it reduces the sort of social penalty of declaring war on them. Like that now, if you declare war on them, you're not considered a warmonger so much because you did give them warning. So it's like, all right, if you want to declare war, like literally I'm the only person who profits from this because I'm already taking your money for the last peace that you tried to negotiate.
They're trying to introduce like Casus Belli as a mechanic, and you can research, I think it's in civics, you can research new excuses.
That is cool.
Which is really neat, actually. It's a really clever idea. So there's one for colonialism, where if you go to war with someone who's like too... stages of civilization behind you, no one cares because you're basically subjugating whatever everyone perceives. Which is
my excuse for killing you is you're really low tech.
Yeah, precisely, and everyone's fine with that. And that stuff's kind of where it starts to get a little bit edgy and interesting. It's just that those are the big decisions I want to be making. It's really silly to me that I can change from a democracy to a theocracy, and it will change the number of card slots with which to apply these kind of tiny things. And I'll endure like one or two turns of anarchy, which don't seem to have a huge amount of effects on my civilization anyway. And it's you change governments like just changing shoes, or it's just a really casual. It should be that should be a massively defining aspect of how your civilization works, how your people live. Should be the type of system they live in, and it's just the kind of stat bonus thing.
It sounds like Stellaris maybe did a better job of that. Mm. I remember hearing that. If you want a kind of like liberal government, then you sort of risk actually being voted out of it. And I think you still keep playing, but like you sort of can't enact certain policies because you're not actually the person who gets to decide that anymore.
You're like the opposition party. Or
I don't know.
Like Jeremy Corbyn.
But yeah, like the kind of government you decide you want actually has an effect on like how much power you have over your own people.
That's interesting. So yeah, I find statistics really spooky actually. Even like the art style is initially really nice. Actually, I would say I really enjoy the initial exploration phase of actually kind of uncovering the map, which is initially beautiful. And they have these natural wonders, which is a really cool idea. Where if you might find Mount Kilimanjaro, and you get specific bonuses for building a city next to Kilimanjaro. That's a really nice idea. But when it comes to like the latter stage of the campaign, the final third. It's an absolute visual chaos. It's just so many bright colours everywhere and just so many numbers. And the interface is actually, I think, really quite bad in a number of respects. Like just building units and improvements. I mean, you have to go click on a city, click on build, and then you have to scroll down through a menu of every single thing that city could possibly build.
Yeah.
And when you're in the latter stages of the game, that is like 50 things.
If you mouse over any of them, the tooltip obscures the others.
Yes.
Like there's so much space on the screen and it puts it above. So it just
there's so many little things like that as well. And, you know, you used to, I think, have governors where you could set what the governors would do to kind of angle that city's focus. So it could be on food or in order to grow the city, or it could be on production in order to make things faster. And all of that is confined to tiny, minuscule pips above the name of each city once you've selected it. And I only just realised that like 2 days ago. And it's a hugely important thing because it gets things built twice as fast if you want them to. There's so much stuff. I was quite surprised it got so lauded, really. Like, so universally praised.
Yeah. I think you're the first person I found who also doesn't like it. You're probably listening to the most negative podcast in SF6 that there is.
I'm kind of so relieved, to be honest, because I was just there thinking, what? None of this really quite works. To counter that, XCOM 2 is one of my favourite games of the year, also made by Firaxis, and is like to me one of the games I'd hold up as a strategy game that makes you take important, difficult decisions all the time. And that's why I love it.
Yeah, I really want to go back to that. I am in two minds though, because I want to, if possible, play it with a gamepad. But
are they going to patch that into the PC version?
Apparently not. They haven't said no, but they somebody I said this on Twitter recently, and somebody said, oh, they don't sound very interested in doing that. And I think somebody actually asked them in an interview, and they just sort of gave us kind of like no plans answer. Because it's out on consoles now, so in theory, like the gamepad control should be there. It does support Steam Controller, in theory, but I don't really like the feel of the Steam Controller. I don't know, I'm having less of trouble with this last time I tried it than when I first tried it, but initially I had real trouble, like, scrolling all the way to the right of the trackpad, like, to do that, to move my hand off the controller, which felt weird. But also, I have a big problem, which is just, like, its configuration system does not work for me, like, functionally. Like, it doesn't... In XCOM, no matter what configuration I select, it always has the same one in-game, and it's a, like, random garbage one. I don't think it's one designed by a human. I think it's a random assignment of buttons to functions. So, like, the left squeeze button cycles to your next soldier. Your right squeeze button, instead of cycling to the previous soldier, zooms out.
Right. Okay.
And the other one doesn't zoom in, so that doesn't feel like something someone's designed. That feels like a weird mess of controls. And that happens if I select the official configuration, or if I select a user configuration, or if I define my own configuration. It just always does that.
If you like, so I ended up reviewing the PS4 version. I could actually just send you how they map the PS4 pad, and you could kind of map that onto your Steam controller setup.
Well, it doesn't seem to actually work.
If I can't actually do it.
Yeah, like, I've tried custom conversions. It just ignores them all. It just always goes back to the same thing.
That's weird.
So, yeah.
As far as going back to XCOM with the two major expansions, I really enjoyed going back to and seeing. There's a really nice array of short-term and long-term challenges and rewards to play around with that let you play in different ways and really, really make you scared of aliens again.
Yeah. Man, the monsters they added, like, the original XCOM 2 already had kind of boss monster type level enemies, but they added a few more just crazy things. That game is amazing and might well be my game of the year.
I would happily buy it again on PlayStation to play with the gamepad, except that I was also, like, since playing it, well, I played it, there were no mods out for it at all that I knew of, and I played the whole game through like that, pretty much, and since then, I keep hearing about all these cool mods, and every time I subscribe to them on Steam, and Steam Workshop's, you know, got a really good system for that, where you just click it once, and it's sort of added to your game and updated automatically. And so I've got this backlog of all these mods that I've been enthusiastically click subscribe on, and like, oh yeah, that sounds like such a sensible tweak. Oh yeah, of course it should work that way. And so now if I go and play the game without access to those, I'm going to be even more bothered by... There's one that just, like... I mean, they're all pretty small things, but there's one that... colour codes all of the icons to their action point cost. So if they're free, they're always one colour. And if they cost one action point, they're always one colour. If they end your turn, they're always one colour.
Yeah, nice.
Which, yeah, once you say it, it's like, of course it should be that way. I played Abzu recently.
The underwater.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The game where you are a sort of... You're a robot cat. Humanoid. That looks like a diver with sort of flipper feet. And it's made by the team that includes the art director of Journey. And the game in general is very much like Journey. It's very much structured like Journey. And it sort of feels like Journey. And it's very beautiful. It's all underwater, pretty much. And you're swimming amongst shoals of fish and... right off the bat, they do a really good job of like making each area starkly different. Like, if you just hear that you're always underwater, it sounds a bit like one note, it's all going to be blue, right? But no, they have, like, I guess because it's the art director of Journey, they have a really good sense of like theming and making each hero feel new. But it doesn't end up working the way that Journey worked for me. Like, Journey I really loved and felt magical, and just all the kind of cliches that I'd heard about it were just came completely true. Yes, I was completely enthralled by this thing, and it was exciting and amazing. And obviously, like, the main thing about Journey is you're sort of secretly cooperating with someone. Like, there's another person in your world, and it is controlled by another player, but they don't tell you who, and they don't tell you if that person drops out and someone else joins in. It's all very mysterious. I don't think that's the whole, like, heart and soul of Journey. I feel like if that didn't have that, it would still be a game I would like. But something else is missing in Abzu. And I think it's very easy to point to a bunch of concrete things it doesn't have that Journey did. Thanks. And I don't know which one of them it is that's stopping it from feeling as magical. Like, I could tell all the places were pretty, and I was going to beautiful places, and it was kind of a cool experience to swim with fishes. But, like, when you come to a puzzle, it's always just, there's these two levers, and you've got to swim to each one of them and pull them both, and then the big door opens, and then you go through it. And there are variations on that, loads of variations on that, but they're all just swim to the lever and pull the lever. Like, you press use on it, and there's always a thing, like, icon telling you to do that, and what your person does can be very different in each circumstance, and the theming of that can be quite different, but it's so just that, that there's no suspense of disbelief. You can never see it as anything other than pulling two levers.
I think the way Pip talked about it, her main problem with it was that it echoed so many of the beats of Journey that it felt too similar.
Yeah, the...
So is your main problem with it that you did better things in Journey?
Well, actually, the most successful part of it for me was the very end, which does a very, very similar thing to Journey. It has a very similar feel of it, where I don't want to spoil any, like, anything that happens, but it has a kind of liberating feel, like, after a sort of dark moment, there's a happy moment, and it's not really challenging, you're just kind of, like, breezing through something in a very fun and playful way, and that worked really well, and I immediately recognised, hey, this is just like the end of Journey. But that didn't bother me, really. It was like, hey, this works for all the same reasons the end of Journey works. Whereas the rest of the game, I had this strange sense of waiting for it to end. Sounds terrible. Like, I wasn't not enjoying it. I was just like, I think it's just... because they're both wordless games. They don't have, like, a written story in the most traditional sense. And so the point of comparison that springs to mind for some reason is trailers, right? You can make a trailer that is just a series of unconnected gameplay clips, or you can make a trailer where you follow, like, the character of the game through a series of things, and even if they're not one after the other in the game, you can make it seem like this is a story the character is going on, and they have a moment of peril and then a moment of success and that kind of stuff. And that kind of trailer, like, if they're both 3 minutes long, the one that has a story will seem to fly by, and you'll be kind of maybe even sad that it ends, and the other one will feel kind of interminable. You're like, okay, come on, get on with it. And that's kind of what Abzu felt like. It does have a thread, like, there is a narrative to it, and I'm not harsh on it because it's wordless, because Journey is also wordless, and that worked really well. It was just, there's a kind of companion-type character, but the way they introduce it, I don't know, maybe I missed some twist after this, but the way they introduce it does not endear you to the creature at all. you do form, like, it is a creature I recognise, and every time it came up, I was like, oh, it's that thing. But I didn't feel any, like, connection to it, which is ironic, because I got an achievement that said, connection, when I did something with it. Do you feel a connection to this creature? No, I don't. But yeah, like, it felt like a series of set pieces and scenes, some of which did involve a thing I recognised, and some of those moments were sad, and some of those moments were happy, but it didn't tie together into a narrative. So it's probably just something like, weirdly, it might be a failure of writing in a game that has no words. It might be the sort of, I guess, narrative design is the word for this in games. Didn't feel like that was as strong as in Journey. But it is very beautiful. There's a lot of scenes in it have that kind of excitement of like, oh, we're doing this. And then something sort of, like, the scenes do individually have pace to them. Like, you have scenes where it's really fast and cool and things are flowing. And then scenes where it's slow and serene, and that's nice too. I kept expecting that to be stitched together into some kind of, like, yeah, more cohesive narrative. It actually reminds me a bit of, like, this will sound really harsh, but, like, if you go to, like, an IMAX experience, or like some, anytime they have new technology, like a sort of in a theme park, if they have like a domed screen or something, they're going to show some fish thing, right? And there's a VR thing, but it's just fish. And fish are just a way you show off cool new technology. It was a bit like one of those, in that it had all those, like, we're going to have a huge whale moment, and we're going to have a huge solar fish moment, and we're going to have a scary shark moment, and we're going to have a weird octopus moment to show off that we can do those things. As in the sort of tech demo type things, they didn't really hang together into anything greater than that. And because it wasn't a tech demo, because it was just on my screen, I sort of expected it to.
How did you find the movement of the character? I've heard completely different
opinions. Two things about it. One is that that's another small thing I can point to that, well, not small really, but a thing I can point to that it doesn't have that Journey does, is sliding down sand dunes of Journey is so much fun. And this is, it's just swimming. It's just like swimming in Tomb Raider, which is fine in Tomb Raider, but if you're going to make a whole game about swimming, I did hope that it would be more naturally fun.
There's a super, then, super gamey boost system.
Yeah.
Which is really at odds for me with the rest of the tone of the rest of the game.
Yeah, there's a like sort of super kick button.
You chain them together in three, and then the third one goes, sets you extra far, apparently, like Mario's jump in.
Oh, I didn't even discover that. What I did discover was that, speaking of super gamey things, when you're in a kind of like slipstream when the current's pulling you along, you need to hit shoals of fish for a speed boost. They're like, the first time this happens, they're like bright red, so you hit the bright red fish for a speed boost, which felt very strange. But then the other thing with the movement is that for some reason, if you turn, if you want to turn 90 degrees, I find that incredibly difficult, because if I hold down right, your character doesn't turn much at all, seems to be taking a long time, and then as soon as you've turned about 30 degrees, the turn sensitivity like quadruples, and so you basically do a 180, but the camera doesn't, and the camera's like, it's too slow to follow you, and so then like my character is now facing the camera.
Right.
So if I press forwards, do I go in the camera direction or the character direction? I don't know. And then I'm trying to turn back left, but the camera hasn't caught up with my right turning yet. And it's really like, it's incredibly pronounced. There's, I don't know what the code looks like, but it feels like there's a really particular threshold where if you've been holding right for this long, oh, you must want to do a 180 degree turn, so we're going to massively increase sensitivity. So yeah, like that wasn't a huge problem, but every now and then it would be irritating. And yeah, I kind of wanted the movement to be more fun.
I think when that's kind of all there is, apart from looking at moving and looking at things, are the two kind of cool things about a game. And
my favourite parts where there are these statues where you can, if you swim over to them, you can meditate. And when you meditate, you can just move the camera around between the fish that are about. And one thing that's really awesome about it is just there's everywhere you go is just full of life. There's so many different fish and different species. And you would never know it when you're playing the game, but when you're meditating, you can see they actually interact with each other. And you can follow like a predator fish, and it will like prey on the shoals of fish and zoom in. Like when it actually bites one, it just kind of disappears, but it's still kind of cool to watch their behaviors interact. It's also like the fish are beautifully modeled. They look really, really good. There are, you know, massive, massive whales that still every detail of them looks perfect. Wow. There are prehistoric fish that it's awesome to swim around with because they have this very like alien feel. And there are just so many different kinds. Like every time you can, in certain situations, you can find out what they're called. And I like quite enjoyed that. I kind of played as a naturalist and like studied all the different fish to find out what they are.
They're all real, right?
Yes, although some of them are not current. Like they're prehistoric, I think. I'm pretty sure the one that looks like Loch Ness Monster is not a real thing. also, like I'm really scared of big underwater things. But I think maybe, I don't know under what circumstances, but this, I think the game, like quite early on, proves to you that nothing is a threat. Like nothing, you're never in any danger in this game at all. And I don't know, I kind of like that, and I didn't want it to be super challenging, but it did. It was strange to be swimming amongst like these terrifying looking creatures, and just the fact that they weren't scary to me, or the fact that the game had told me not to be scared of them, by showing that they would never attack me, made me just believe in them a bit less. It actually felt like an aquarium where there's a glass barrier between them. It's like, well, you know, it's not a literal glass barrier, but this thing can never interact with me, so I don't have to worry about it. And I feel like maybe if I was going to make a game about fish, and I don't think they did, but I think they should have, because they're really good at fish, then at least an element of that should be that they're of some danger to you in some situations. And I don't know what the game I wanted was, but it feels like they put so much work into that and they did it so well. I would love the game to be about the fish, but instead the fish are just kind of in the background while you pull the two levers to open the big gate.
Have you played Subnautica yet?
No. I've heard Pip talk about it a lot, and that does sound maybe more my kind of thing.
Those things are dangerous.
Yes. Although there's like a non-survival mode, right, where you... Or an always survival mode where you don't have to worry about dying, right?
You don't have to worry about food and water.
Oh, okay.
But you still have to worry about the things with the big teeth.
Ah. Huh.
I was unnerved to see one of the latest Subnautica updates. I played it before this, in which you have a tiny little submarine, and even when you find the biggest, scariest thing, you can kind of get away from it in your tiny submersible. But one of the patch notes was introducing a creature which can teleport you out of your submarine.
Oh my god.
And I'm never going back.
That's horrible. Shall we do questions?
Let's do that.
Yeah.
We have one from James, who writes, I just finished Darksiders 2, a solid 7 out of 10. But I feel that it could have been much better if some of the less interesting dungeons and systems had been cut. The back end of the game feels like it stretched out. Butter? Oh, butter over too much bread, etc. And a shorter, more focused game would have been fine by me. Imagine you're an editor. What would you cut from games you've liked in order to improve them? Best wishes, James. I would cut religion from Civ 6. I don't know. I was going to say, I can see why it's interesting. Maybe I can't see why it's interesting. But definitely, like, I don't want to engage with it, and I don't want it to interfere with what I'm doing. And again, it's another thing that just feels like a list of plus ones and plus minus ones.
It's quite funny, because the AI seemingly likes to create an army of missionaries and deploy them like some sort of military operation across your territory to kind of convert your followers. And I did have fun creating the Cult of the God Emperor as my own religion in a kind of attempt to turn Civilization VI into 40k, but still, no, that system wasn't very interesting.
I really enjoyed my RPGs, and I would cut the pickpocket skill from every single one.
Oh, really?
Because it just leads to save scumming.
It certainly does in Elder Scrolls.
I don't think I've seen an implementation of it that isn't entirely flawed and just flips. If you fail, it just flips whoever you're pickpocketing into some kind of aggro status, from which it's always better to immediately reload.
Yeah. Yeah, I wonder, could you make a good version of that? I mean, if it's random at all, then people will save scum, unless you totally take out saving. Mm. But could you have something where, I remember in Skyrim, it was your chance of successfully pickpocketing was dependent on the weight of the object, which I could, oh, would it also depend on the value? It might have been dependent on the value as well.
Makes no sense.
But I can sort of see it, like, if you have a precious ring, you just pay a lot of attention to where it is. Like, they can't really model which pocket it's in, but you would have put it in your safest pocket, I guess. But you could do something where, like, your pickpocket skill is the amount of stuff you can steal from a given person before they notice you. Your pickpocket skill is 50, so you can steal 50 gold's worth of stuff before they notice you. Then I suppose you wouldn't have, like, if you're a thief, you want to steal that 10,000 gold ring. And so if you just flat out can't, there's no chance of doing it. Maybe that's less interesting.
You just get into weird design territory where, in order to reward the skill, you have to put valuable things on characters. But because you can never see who's really got what equipped, then you have to pickpocket every single character in the game. And it's just...
Yeah, I remember that was a change in Skyrim where pickpocketing just to see what people have was no longer a crime. Like, you could never be caught for it, no matter how bad you were, so you could just sneak after everyone, just look through all their pockets. And say, that's all right, I didn't take anything. You can't arrest me for this.
It's just a weird vestigial thing from old D&D implementation that just has to die, I think.
Mm-hmm. What if you could take something, but you had to replace it with something with the exact same weight?
Yeah, Jane style.
Oscar writes, I've never actually achieved a cultural victory in the Civ game, so I could be completely wrong on how they play out, but I always like the concept as it feels closest to reality. You can make a reasonable argument that the USA have won actual real-life civilization through cultural ubiquity. However, you're still limited by Forex mechanics, which would never allow for Britain, Spain, France, and the Ottomans to be neck and neck for most of the game, only to be utterly trounced at the last minute by a country that didn't even exist until turn 150. This is why Europa Universalis is the best strategy game. Thanks for reading, everybody. Oscar. It's not really a question, but it's an interesting point.
It's quite funny, isn't it?
It's something that struck me, obviously USA's culture is very pervasive in England and in other countries, but it's also interesting how much Japanese culture pervades America, particularly given their history together. You would almost expect there to be like a cultural barrier there, but it feels like the opposite, like they sort of both absorb each other's culture a huge amount.
Yeah, this is my problem with the way that Civilization, a lot of 4X games, choose to depict culture as some sort of combat or some sort of, you know, if one culture is greater than the other is belittled in some way, whereas it's actually just an empathic exchange of values across through very many different mediums. And like the USA has been enormously successful at that, and Britain with, you know, their music and, you know, television has also been bizarrely successful given our size. you know, Beatles did quite well. Yeah, so this idea of culture is kind of a mechanic that increases empathy between nations rather than one nation dominating another nation through culture. It seems like more realistic to me.
Since I was given a talk about this by someone from the Swedish government, I will say that that Sweden is disproportionately effective at video games, basically. Like video games are a huge cultural export, and they have a freakish number of the, you know, both of the two biggest mobile games companies in the world are there, and also Minecraft, and also
Dice.
And yeah, huge number of developers are there, way out of proportion to their population, and I think even to their, like, you know, economic weight in other areas. And he says that it's because of a bunch of factors, one of which is it's very dark for a very long time so like video games are a good thing to do. Dungeons and Dragons was huge there like 20 years ago, and he also attributes a lot of it to I'm not going to be able to remember the name of the poet slash thinker, but there is someone who's like, his whole shtick was, don't think you're special, you're not special, get over yourself, you're a fucking nobody. And that is like the Swedish cultural philosophy. Like, it's completely ingrained in their culture. And so at their developers, they don't really have like rock stars usually. It's a much more of a team thing, and no one's allowed to think that they are super important to the project. Everyone kind of just sees themselves as part of a team. And this fellow who's given us the talk reckons that that is why a lot of their developers are so successful, is because they're not sort of ruined by prima donnas going off and wrecking everything.
I'm not sure America has 100% total cultural domination. No, I can't watch My Super Sweet 16 without waving a gun in the air and shouting death to the West.
If cultural victory is decided by the highest tourism score at the end of next exactly, turn, <yeah. laughs> do they have that, or...
I think New Zealand might win.
Yeah, exactly. Like, tourism, oh man, it almost has as much to do about how affordable a plane journey is as to do with the the great artifacts that are in the place.
Yeah.
You know.
Mr. Wendell writes, in Pod 162, there was talk about 4X games needing a better end. I think 4X games could solve their dragged out endings by giving you smaller goals contextual to the current situation. I once played a game of Galciv 3 as the Iconians. According to their backstory, they were kicked off their homeworld by their creation, the AI mechanical species, the Yor. So my game became about reclaiming our old homeworld, and when I did, I felt a sense of completion and stopped right there. I didn't need to wipe out all the Yor and mop up the entire map, or go for one of the other longer and less interesting victory conditions. Have you ever created your own victory conditions for a game and stopped playing there rather than going through until the game was told you it was over? Yes. I think that was an interesting story, that it's hard to know whether like that could be institutionalized into the game and say, if you're playing as the Iconians, then all you have to do is capture this one world. That would be a much more decisive end. Like, once you do that, it would be over. And until you do that, it's not over. And you can imagine a situation where, like, you do that because you're militarily dominant, or you can imagine a situation where you're not militarily dominant and you're like, okay, how can I still sneakily get influence in that one world? So that sounds kind of good.
It's so difficult though, because I mean, it depends so much on the player, like what the player decides victory means to them is just so subjective and hard to guess, I imagine, from a design perspective.
Yeah.
So you have to go for these big generalist kind of victory conditions. I would call out Ender's Legend as being very good at creating quest lines. It actually gives you quests to try and endear yourself to like local, individual, small civilizations. And you could do that to get items, you could do that just to ingratiate yourself with them so that they will help you in wars and stuff. But it does actually give you some little narrative threads that are more direct than civilization's giant, kind of make your giant sandbox richer and then win through richness eventually somehow, either through, you know, meaningless culture points or religious points. So, thing is, like, Civilization doesn't really feel like it's supposed to be a sandbox to me. Maybe that's why I have problems with it, because it feels like there's supposed to be an end game. There's supposed to be some sort of conclusion to it. It's just that those conclusions are always unsatisfying. Maybe that's my problem.
Yeah. I guess another question is, like, do the AI know what your goal is? Because that's the thing that... definitely in Galsir, if I remember. Yeah, like, you... One of the victory conditions was, like, going for these crystals, and if you had 2/3 of those crystals, you were going to win in 100 turns, and if you had all of the crystals, then you were going to win in 50 turns or whatever. And so when someone's, like, going for those crystals, you fucking know what they're trying to do, and you will stop them at all costs. Whereas, certainly if you've made up your own objective, the AI have no hope of stopping you doing it intentionally. They can only hope to accidentally stop you doing it. And that thing of, like, trying to capture this one world, if everyone knew you're trying to capture that one world, and that if you did, the game would be over.
That'd be really intense.
But, like, the way he, Mr. Wendell's story plays out is actually, that was his victory condition, but it isn't the failure condition for the other factions. The other faction, I mean, the Yor probably don't like that he took Iconia, but everyone else probably doesn't care whether Iconians have Iconia or whether the Yor have Iconia. And so, it might be interesting if, like, wiping it or stopping everyone else from winning is one objective, but then if you can't do that or if you don't want to do that, you have a personal thing where it's like, well, as long as you do that, you've fulfilled your your own goal.
Your people are happy.
Yeah. I've had games where, particularly games where I realise I'm not going to win, I'll pick something else. I'll be like, okay, but I'm going to hold this fucking planet. You're not getting this planet from me. Bean writes, after the dust has settled and most people have stopped talking about the game, are there any games that you find quotable?
There's one line from the original Fallout which has stuck with me for 15 years. I think it is when you finally reach the boss of the game called the Master. It's a weird creature made of blended personalities, and he offers you a choice to either join or die. But it does it in a really weird voice. It says, "Join, die, join, die." And that's just lasted forever. It might be on my tombstone, I don't know.
Actually, speaking of weird voices, look at you, hacker. Certainly quoted that in articles a lot.
That's a good one.
A pathetic creature of meat and bone running through my corridors? I can't remember the rest of it.
That's a good one. That's a good choice.
I personally don't quote it, but I often hear quoted Portal 2, J.K. Simmons' character saying, when life gives you lemons, don't make lemonade, fucking take them back, complain to life's management, demand to see the manager, throw the lemons back at them, turn them into combustible lemons and burn their house down with them.
That's another excellent choice. I instead have gone for Bulletstorm's character, Trishka Novak, who screams at all point, "I will kill your dicks!" to which the main character replies, "What? What does that even mean? You're going to kill my dick? I'll kill your dick, how about that, huh?" And for me, that is the peak of FPS dialogue.
She's like the psychic, right? You actually end up
going through the game with her. And like, Bulletstorm, I've got a lot of love for Bulletstorm for just being really subconsciously pulpy. And it's lines like that that kind of set it up as being just very kind of self-aware, stupid.
Yeah, it used to be my favourite bark in a game was Far Cry 1's mercenaries, who would say, "I'm going to shoot you in the face!" whilst attempting to shoot you in the face. I thought, fair enough, you know what you're about.
You know your place.
If each of you were a leader in Civ 6, what would your traits be and why? I don't know, but I feel like what I would want them to be is, I like stealth games, I don't know if you've noticed this, but I would like my trait to be like, all of my people, and indeed my entire cities, are invisible to everybody. And so nobody even knows I'm in the game, like, for as long as the game goes on, unless they like actually try and settle in the same place as me or something. And so if I win, then it's a complete surprise for everybody. They didn't even know that that I was in the game until I win.
I figure I would have default kind of levels, military and economic and stuff, but I have a massive vulnerability to culture victories. You could just beat me constantly by just showing me pretty pictures.
The latest HBO drama, and that's it. The culture's just like, that's fine. I'll be with you now.
I do like this idea that sort of you absorb enough of someone's culture, you just sign up to be part of their nation. Like, that's, to its credit, that's not what Civ 6 does, but it is what Galciv does. It's like, if you give them your culture enough. I would like the game to like explain more about this. Not because I don't think it can happen, because I think it's a fun idea that like someone likes your culture, like to a certain point, like it's not that they technically gain citizenship in your nation. It's just that there's no point in even considering them part of this their original culture now, because like if you told them to go to war, they would go to war, and if they told them not to, they wouldn't.
I think the traits I would really like to have was to always get Jane Austen in whatever time period or circumstance, really.
Yep. We're here in Bath, where Jane Austen spent all the time.
She spent some time here briefly and hated it.
Really?
To her diaries, so.
We have the Jane Austen Museum.
I know, but
is that what they tell you when you go? Jane Austen, frankly, hated this
place.
They
don't talk about that, no.
Every now and then I meet someone and they ask where I'm from and I say Bath, and they're like, oh my god, I love Jane Austen.
Really?
Oh, okay. Keys McQueen writes, what games could you do with a Hitman-like episodic format? Maybe something like Tomb Raider with a new tomb every month, or Portal? Portal's a good show, actually. That was, although its story was sort of important, I feel like you can also make an episodic game where, well, you could still have a story in an episodic game, of course. But even just one-off puzzle things would be fun. That said, Portal 2 has a great level editor, and it has a really healthy community of people making awesome levels, and I don't play any of them.
Yeah,
I think I played one once, and it was really difficult, and it was good, but it was difficult. Actually, maybe I did like a little roundup for PC Gamer and did like 5 of them or something when it was relatively new, but I haven't looked back since, even though I know there will be great puzzles there, and I could be having fun with them. There's something about like, I need it to be a sort of an episode, I think. Hmm. Like, an individual level is not enough. It needs to be, like, Valve have made, even if it's all community-made maps, if Valve said, here's a new chapter of Portal that we've decided these maps are worthy of.
Is it like a narrative thread or something?
Yeah, maybe. I don't think I strictly need that, either.
I think any of the kind of big FPS shooters could do a kind of massively over-the-top campaign or just a mission every month. That'd be quite fun. But
yeah, that'd be sweet. Like Battlefield 1 has done a really nice job of kind of its campaign is a series of kind of vignettes of from all over the war, and some of them are like super kind of pop fiction. Like the one I played where like the war where you play as an American who's kind of stolen the position of a British flying ace, and that you're suddenly flying planes and shooting down German zeppelins and stuff like that and crashing into them. Like anything that nuts and just really fun every kind of 3 months, I'd probably be really into. Likewise, I absolutely adore the Blood and Wine expansion for The Witcher 3, and like I'd take one of those every year for a long time, I think, before I got bored, if they were of that quality and, you know, enough of a variation. Those are just The Witcher 3 does amazing short stories. Its kind of long form story is just really kind of trad RPG with all the kind of bloated lore behind it, but its short stories are absolutely brilliant. Like, I'd buy into a series of those episodically.
I wouldn't be surprised to see a lot more companies doing stuff like this. I imagine a lot of producers and marketing execs have taken note how Hitman appears back on websites every single month without fail.
Yeah.
And we'll say, oh, yeah,
it's always
the
news. It's always on our podcast. Although actually, I feel like it's past our capacity to keep up with it lately. Well, certainly my capacity to keep up with it. Like we've talked about the new one, like the second to last one. I don't think we mentioned it at all.
I think it's Peace Gamers Phil Savage. We've made him review every single one. And it's become kind of in joke in the office that it's his burden now that he must go forth and review the latest Hitman episode. And he really enjoys the game. He just struggles to find, like, it's like every time he reviews, it's like still good. It's still a good Hitman game. And once it's complete, might be one of the best. You know.
Funny, it might be an almost misleading example for other developers to follow because. They just also really nailed the game. Like, right. If they had made this as a, you know, 8 hour or, you know, 8 or 6 mission game that, you know, took however long that takes to play, and released it all at once, it would still, you know, be getting like 90% or whatever.
Hmm.
Cause it's just like, they really understood what makes Hitman great in a way that they haven't done since Blood Money.
Yeah.
But I guess, yeah, I think maybe it is a good example to copy for, yeah, the reason you say, John, it's just always in the news. You can't get away from it. There's definitely, because I have struggled to keep up with it, and I'm the biggest Hitman fan. I'm not the biggest, clearly, but I was like a huge evangelist for Blood Money, and was always saying like, I really, really want more games like this, and I like would be happy for them to be episodic, and I would, if you just released more Blood Money missions once a month, I would be buying them forever.
Mm.
In retrospect, I'd like to amend that and say once every 4 months. I actually can't keep up with once a month because there's a lot to do in them. And like, you know, I'm one behind at the moment. Like I'm still on the Thailand one and then there's another one out, but I don't feel ready to go on to it because I haven't really explored the last one properly yet.
I think the great thing about the Hitman thing with regards to Hitman specifically is that those levels endure a lot of attention, especially their best levels at Sapien.
Yeah.
But they might endure a month's worth of attention from someone who's playing like 4 or 5 hours a week. And it's hard to say that for many games, this is like a sandbox simulation game where you create one piece of architecture, but lots of different things can happen inside it.
Mm.
And if a game's not necessarily like that, then, for example, the replay value for a Battlefield 1 mini campaign is going to be nil, basically. Once you've gone through it, that's it. So maybe that episodic format depends on the kind of replayability of the thing in some way.
That is all the questions we have time for. If you'd like to send us questions, you can do so at questions@creightoncrowbar.com, and you can also tweet them at us. We're at creightoncrowbar on Twitter. You can hang out on our Discord channel, which will be linked in the show notes. You can post things on our forum, which is creightoncrowbar.com/forum. And you can follow us on Twitter individually. I am at Pentadact, PENTADACT. Tom, what are you?
I'm at PCTLudo, which is LUDO.
John, what are you?
I am JOHN_ARR.
Thanks for listening, everybody!